And around 12,000 paramedics in England will receive pay rises worth thousands of pounds.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, continuing our All Along the Watchtower series, Bristol City Walls briefing for tonight on Gladio C as ISIS prepares to launch a wave of bomb attacks, we're told, here in Britain. But what is Gladio C, and what evidence is there that the 7/7 London bombings, Paris, Nice, Brussels attacks across Europe were actually carried out and orchestrated by Islamists? As the Russians and the Syrian Arab Army liberate Aleppo and 1,500 terrorists, we're told, return from Syria to Europe, the EU, Europol and the new boss of MI6, Alex Younger, are warning us of this new wave of terror attacks right across Britain and Europe, organised from Syria. So we hear from FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds all about what she discovered of this network of NATO terrorists trained to blow up innocent people across Europe and blame those attacks on Islamic groups. Also, as Network Rail gets ready to be privatised, what will it mean for passengers? Or are we the last in the queue, as usual, as public assets are auctioned off to the government's chums? And to discuss that first, that last story there about Network Rail, I'm joined by Bruce Williamson, and he's from Rail Futures. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the Politics
Show. Hello.
Now, you've done a bit of media on this week, haven't you? National media.
It's been a very busy week for us, actually. Yeah, we did two interviews. the media's gone wild.
Okay,
very, very interested in this story.
So what's the justification we're getting from the government about why they should be selling off the rail tracks?
Well, and they're not quite selling off the rail track. That's not entirely true. But the justification is this. You have an organisation, Network Rail, which manages the tracks. We all know that. And we have the train operating companies that run the trains on those tracks.
And we got in the sandwich, you've got
the Roscoes, yeah.
And now Roscoe stands for?
Rolling Stock Company. So a lot of people don't know this, that First Great Western or Southern or whoever don't actually own the trains that they run under their own livery on their franchise.
Now, what's the logic behind that?
The logic is this, that if, let's say, First Great Western owned the trains and First Great Western lost the franchise, they would still own the trains, and they would have the next franchisee over a barrel, because they'd say, well, we've got the trains that run on this line, you know, pay us £10 million apiece, you know, when they're only worth three, or whatever, I don't know. So they have to separate out, you know, the ownership of the trains from the operation of the trains for that reason. So you have the rolling stock companies, Network Rail, and the train operating companies themselves that actually, you know, they have very little room for manoeuvre, the train operating companies.
Now, I was just looking at the companies that actually own the rolling stock. Mm. A lot of them actually, for a long time, one of them was just simply wholly owned by HSBC Bank.
Yes.
I mean, they're not necessarily some guy sitting in his shed who's done loads of work and he's managed to do this. No, it is actually just big financial institutions have decided they can make a lot of money doing this.
Indeed, and they did, especially I think in the early days of rail privatisation. I think that's one of the reasons why it's controversial.
They used a holding company. I think that's what they did. They basically created a new company, bought all the shares in that, controlled that, and it just had a different name. So anyway.
So you've got this sort of fragmentation, and it would make sense, wouldn't it, that you integrate the track and the train, because obviously they naturally go hand in hand. And the idea is that the train operating companies know what happens on their patch. You know, they're the sort of, if you like, the regional or the local experts. They know what the priorities are, what the bottlenecks are, where there are problems on their bits of track. And so The idea is if you sort of devolve control of your own bit of track to the train operating companies, then it might result in a little bit more efficiency and a little bit more smoother running of the railways.
Well, that would all be very well if the train operating companies were working efficiently. As we heard at Prime Minister's Questions this week, they're not necessarily, even though Peter Bottomley wanted to say that actually Southern Rail were in the right to get rid of guards. But anyway, let's have a quick listen to that clip.
Sir Peter Bottomley!
Perhaps thinking of rail passengers trying to get to their jobs, the General Secretary of the TUC spoke about shafted and abandoned workers, while the Unite Union's Len McCluskey is doing a UKIP dance move, resigning before trying to return. Will my right honourable friend encourage union and other political leaders to tell the RMT that 250 people with guaranteed employment should not bring the lives, the jobs and the safety of 600,000 Southern Rail passengers at risk?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that my honourable friend will be speaking on behalf of many thousands of rail passengers in his constituency and many others in the south of England. And it's deeply disappointing that some unions are threatening to strike over the Christmas period. The government is now investing record amounts in improving our railways, up to £40 billion over the next 5 years, and we need everyone in industry, both management and unions, to work together to secure the best deal for passengers. I have to say that the RMT's action shows coordinated contempt for the travelling public. And it seems designed to do nothing except bring about the maximum damage to people's lives. Mr. Speaker, there is some heckling from the benches opposite. This party, Mr. Speaker, is on the side of rail passengers. And I hope that the party opposite will join me in saying to the rail union leaders, sort it out, put the travelling public first, stop the squabbling and tell your members to get back to work.
Well, the view we didn't get there was that from Sadiq Khan, the London Mayor. He's saying the government is abandoning passengers on Southern Rail. So things aren't all rosy with the train operating companies, are they, Bruce?
They certainly aren't. And Southern is very much the villain of the piece at the moment, and for a number of reasons. But, you know, as you might expect, it's very much a sort of mixed bag, you know. What's notable, of course, as you're probably aware, that many of the train operating companies are owned by the state-owned railway companies of other European countries, such as, you know, the Netherlands and France and Germany. So we have this bizarre situation where our privatised railway is being run by the state-owned railways of other countries. It's quite funny, really, isn't it?
There's some logic behind it. Do you think that that's reasonable, or is this just what I said at the top of the hour, which is selling off to your mates more things to sell off? We've got some assets here.
They're not actually being sold off, are they? It's about management. You know, the ownership of the track will remain within Network Rail. It's the maintenance and running of it. But of course, it's a mixed blessing. So on the one hand, you get this supposed advantage, which may indeed be an advantage, that you've got integration of track and train locally, so that everything's working together. But the other danger, well, there's two dangers that I see. Firstly, is that you're fragmenting Network Rail, because quite obviously you've got a sort of knowledge base of expertise within Network Rail and some sort of, you know, very expensive specialised capital equipment and so on. And for a sort of an operation like Network Rail, it makes sense to have it operating as a whole. And the second concern is that you are simply introducing another layer of bureaucracy to the running of the railways, and Lord knows there are already enough layers of bureaucracy in running.
Well, there's another side to this, isn't it? Because one of the things I've noticed that quite often train operating companies, they don't actually have enough carriages on a specific train. So what they'll do is they'll say, well, we think that this is the minimum number of carriages we need to run this service, and even if people have to sort of sit in the aisles and they're not actually going to get a seat, that's okay because it's cheaper for us. So they're cutting costs by doing that right across the country. I mean, in fact, there was a whole sort of spat, wasn't there, with Jeremy Corbyn a few months ago,
about him sitting
on a train.
Yeah.
You don't want to sit on the floor, you want a seat, and the train operating companies aren't interested.
No, that's not true. I mean, it is true that there aren't enough carriages to go around and people have to sit on the floor.
Don't they do that on purpose?
No, they don't. No, not at all. This is all very much in the control of government, and it's going back to what I was saying about the train operating companies being micromanaged by the government, the Department for Transport. The train operating companies don't get to choose which trains they run.
How long they are?
Because they don't have enough. That's the whole point. When you see a train that is too short, and the obvious question is, well, why don't they just put on an extra carriage? The answer is, they don't have
one. So whose responsibility is it to actually maintain these trains? Surely it's
the maintenance is done
by private companies.
Yeah, but the ownership and the allocation of rolling stock is managed centrally by the Department for Transport, and there's a desperate shortage of rolling stock right across the network. And this is another reason why, you know, you have this separation of ownership of the trains and the operation of them, is because when you want to buy some more trains, you have to make a big order. You know, I can't just go and buy another Intercity 125 now, because they don't make them anymore, for the same reason that I can't go and buy a Ford Sierra, you know. Whereas if I went to Ford and I said, I want 10,000 Ford Sierras, they might reopen their production line. So the government has to manage the purchasing of these large orders of rolling stock, and then they allocate them through the Roscoes to the different train operating companies. So the government is very much in control here, and the poor old train operating companies have very little room for manoeuvre.
Also, with First Great Western, I mean, they're our local franchise, backwards and forwards to Paddington, the main operator that people will be using from Temple Meads, etc. Looking back at their past, First Group have got a massive debt that they're having to service in the United States. In fact, they nearly went bust 3 or 4 years ago, completely bust. In other words, so, you know, that would have been extremely embarrassing. But they managed to refinance, and some jiggling around was done, and a little bit lower interest rates were paid. So it's a little bit galling, isn't it, to know that when you're buying your train ticket, actually most of it is just going to a bank in America somewhere to service a loan.
Well, I don't think you know, most of it is. It's an argument, obviously, against the privatisation of the railways, that the train operating companies have to take a profit. But to be fair to them, the level of profit is actually very small. You know, it's only, I think it's typically about 3%, whereas most capitalism, you look for a return of about 5% or more. So they're operating a fairly tight ship.
Because isn't it? I mean, I'm sure I remember reading that what they do when they bid for these contracts is they often bid underneath what they know it's going to cost them, knowing that at least for a few years they'll be able to make some money, and then maybe they'll fold in some way, or maybe pull out of the contract before it comes to its end. The main thing is to win the contract. All eyes are focused on that.
Well, I'm not sure that's true either. I mean, you're right that there have been examples recently of franchisees folding on the East Coast Main Line, but the vast majority of franchisees have run their course, and, you know, they're quite fiercely fought after by various different companies who are all making bids.
You mentioned the East Coast Main Line, because this is a perfect example, isn't it? Delivered some scores of millions of pounds to the Exchequer, and also delivered the best public service anywhere in the country when it was nationalised in government hands.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's not anymore, and the figures are starting to return to normal. In other words, overcrowded trains, dissatisfied customers, far less money actually coming into the Exchequer.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact figures are. I mean, you're right that I think the temporarily nationalised East Coast Main Line was a success, and probably for ideological reasons, well, certainly for ideological reasons, the government decided to re-privatise it. But don't forget that, you know, many of the privatised rail companies on the profitable lines are paying huge premiums to the government as well. It's not a one-way street. And overall, the running of trains as a business, if you like, costs nothing to the taxpayer, so it is in a colloquial term, washing its own face.
Okay.
Some lines need subsidy, some lines make a huge profit.
They do, and one of the other things they do on these huge profit making lines, like the London Bristol to London Paddington, is they squeeze everybody in, don't they? You used to have lovely kind of comfy seats where you could stretch your feet out.
Yeah.
Now it's like you're on a cattle truck.
Well, I mean, I agree it's a problem, and
even that cattle truck is overcrowded.
Yeah, but hang on, what do you do if you're First Great Western? As I've said before, they don't have any extra trains. They just can't put on any more. They can't lengthen the trains. So they have to find a way of squeezing in more passengers. But, I mean, it's symptomatic. And, again, you know, it goes back to the government. It's symptomatic of decades of underinvestment in the railways. And we've had the last 20 years, rail passenger numbers have doubled. on the railways. Double. That's quite something, you know. And we certainly don't have anywhere near twice as many trains or twice as many lines or twice as many stations. And so, you know, we are concerned that the investment hasn't kept up. I mean, there is some very, very welcome investment going on now, although, you know, I'm very concerned that the investment of electrification on the Great Western seems to have been paused and stopped at Chippenham,
That's quite good, isn't it? The
investment is good, but the fact it stopped is
worrying. This is a sort of mini HS2 they're doing on the London to Paddington, the idea of electrifying it. The idea really being that some nice little companies who are quite cosy with the Department of Transport are going to get these lovely maintenance contracts, and every time one of those little wires goes a little bit skewy, they're going to make a fortune at it. There's going to be massive amounts of money spent on maintaining the overhead lines.
No, I'm afraid I can't agree at all. That really is a barking mad conspiracy theory. Electrification, firstly, is something we've been pushing for a long, long time. And electrification results in, you know, a faster railway, a more reliable railway. Overhead lines are more reliable than diesel engines. They're cheaper to run, they're cheaper to buy. There's all the green advantages you get from electrification as well.
Well, you're just shoving the pollution somewhere else.
You are shoving the pollution somewhere else, but overall, it's still much more efficient.
Nuclear waste driving your train rather than diesel.
But it can be run by wind, it can be run by hydro, it can be run by solar. The point is, the pollution coming out of your power station is a lot less than the pollution that would be coming straight out of your diesel exhaust on the train.
Is it more than the car, if all those people were in their cars?
It's probably a lot less than if those people were in their cars. You know,
Thank you for making my point for me.
No, but your point was that you're just transferring the pollution. I'm saying that electrifying the railways reduces pollution overall. And I've lost the thread of where I was going. I was going to say something else as well. But your next question, please.
Sorry. Well, I mean, I just think that it's actually quite good that they're not doing that. It just seems to me you keep it simple. You know, this is the way you do run any business. And then once you've got whatever it is, 100 miles, 120, whatever it is, into Cardiff of all this extra superstructure over the top of the train, you may well actually end up getting more delays and certainly vast amounts more spent on keeping the rail track up to scratch.
No, again, I disagree that the maintenance cost is actually relatively low. Overall, it's cheaper to run. I mean, certainly the implementation of electrification, as we've seen, is very disruptive. And sadly, those overhead lines aren't pretty. But it's the pain is definitely worth it for the gain.
The long and the short is, really, it's about, actually, I can go in the car cheaper than I can go on the train.
Yeah, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. I mean, if you're a regular commuter, I mean, people sort of wince at the cost of season tickets, but on a per journey
70
basis,
70 quid to London, isn't it?
Hang on,
the train.
Yeah, it can be. It depends when you go.
That's a day return, isn't it? With a bit of underground as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree that rail is too expensive. You know, it's one of the things we're at Rail Future campaign for is cheaper fares. But, you know, nonetheless, we still want to encourage people to use the trains. And it seems that despite the government's best efforts to price people off with their rail tickets, people are still using the trains in ever-increasing numbers.
If it's one person, you're having to pay 75 quid to go to London and back. I mean, if you've got two or three people going with you, kids in the car, where it's a no-brainer. There's no way you're going to go on the train.
I agree. But your point is what? I mean, like I say, the railways are still...
How are we going to turn that around?
How are we going to turn that around?
The idea is you don't want to, because we've already got too many people on the trains.
Well, part of it is all down to investment. Again, you continue the long-term investment. What's really bad for the railways is feast and famine, and that's what we have had in the past and what we're having now with this pause, this interruption to the Great Western electrification, which is, you know, it's a major concern. But if you have that long-term investment and you commit to it in the very long term, then you will have enough trains to deal with the overcrowding, and then you can start to address, well, you can do it simultaneously. You can address the issue of the cost of rail travel, but the government has a very deliberate policy of shifting the cost of running the railways from the taxpayer onto the passenger, and you know, it's a political thing, but whilst it's sort of still not deterring passengers, I suppose it's whilst it's painful for the passengers, the railway itself is still a huge success.
Okay, well, Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. And Martin Summers, would you want to put your two halfpence in here?
Well, obviously, I was opposed to rail privatisation in the first place. So when you're talking about getting these companies back onto the board of Network Rail, it's like reinventing British Rail by the back door in a way. Although, of course, they're fragmenting the network. One of the things that when you were talking about electrification, I was thinking about the Chinese and are talking about doing maglev trains right across the whole of Central Asia. Do we need to think even bigger than just electrification? I mean, one of the problems with our track is it's too narrow, isn't it? I mean, if we'd had a five metre gauge or whatever, which Brunel originally wanted, then we would have been in a different position than the one we're in now. Because of all the infrastructure, means that, you know, if the station's only that long, it doesn't matter if you put an extra carriage on, because you can't get anybody on the train anyway.
Sorry, yeah, there's a number of points here I will pick up. Yeah, there's maglev, I think, is a little bit of a rich man's toy. You know, it's hideously expensive.
What, like HS2 then?
No, it's not.
HS2.
Well, save HS2 for another program, because there's an awful lot I could say about that. But the point is, the fastest maglev trains in the world are only about 5 miles an hour faster than the fastest conventional trains. And they're hideously expensive and hideously thirsty when it comes to fuel. So let's stick with conventional rail, which works, which is reliable, which has proved to be popular. You're right about the width of the trains. Britain's trains are narrower than the ones in continental Europe, but that's not the same, and they're also not as tall as well. The bridges and the tunnels prevent us from putting...
This is path dependency, isn't it? Decisions made in the past
tie
your hands
when you're
trying to deal with the future.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, if the price of going to London on a day return was half of what it is, you get loads more people using it.
You don't need to have gigantic...
I mean, mainly it should be, surely, about people just being able to get around, getting backwards and forwards to work, that sort of thing. You don't need to have gigantic tracks.
There's nothing
to
wrong
do
with
that.
Subsidising things if you want to have them. Yeah. They don't all have to make a profit. That's a delusion.
I'm not going to let you get away without giving us at least in a nutshell on HS2. What do you make of it?
Okay, Rail Future as an organisation supports it because we need the capacity. I personally agree with that. We do need the capacity, but there's an awful lot wrong with it. The ridiculously high speed, the routing through the Chilterns, the lack of integration with the existing rail network. I think that I'd love them to go back to the drawing board and start again and get it right, but it's not going to happen. But I think it will happen in its existing form. And we will be able to go from London to Birmingham very fast, and know the tickets won't cost £8 million each. But it could be better.
Okay, Steve. Sorry, Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures. Thanks very much for joining us.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, this week we've heard from Europol, the European Union, today, talking to interior ministers and the Home Secretary from Britain, and also the new boss of MI6, Alex Younger, all about the possibility of a new wave of terror attacks across Britain and Europe, Martin, organised from Syria.
Well, yes, booga booga. Be afraid, be very afraid. If we were talking about Syria in the first hour, the evidence is overwhelming that the Turkish intelligence services, the other NATO intelligence services, including MI6, and their allies in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, have been definitely involved in supporting jihadi terrorism inside Syria. Michael Flynn, who's the new head of defence intelligence in the US, leaked the DIA report when he was the head of the DIA, saying that ISIS was deliberately created by the US regime.
Yeah, he said it was a willful decision.
Willful decision. So all the evidence suggests that these ISIS terrorists and other terrorists like the Al-Nusra Front operating in Aleppo, they've been armed and trained and directed by NATO intelligence services. And at the same time, these same intelligence services are saying we've got to be afraid, very afraid, of Islamist terrorism. I think we've got to ask the obvious question. Who are the terrorists?
So go on, answer your own question.
The NATO intelligence services, who've been orchestrating and running jihadi terrorism since Operation Cyclone in the 1980s. I'm quite sure that is the conclusion of the Russian General Staff.
Okay, so what about this whole idea of Gladio B? We heard from Sybil Edmonds a few weeks ago a bit about that. We'll be hearing more in a minute. But she was saying that Gladio B was done after the first Gladio, which was really about opposing the Soviet Union in Europe and having fascists run by NATO doing bomb attacks across Europe, mainly in Italy, but also in countries like Belgium and Germany. And then they would immediately blame those on these Russian-backed groups and Soviet Union-connected groups in Gladio A. Mm. Gladio B, a little bit different. Once there was the fall of the Soviet Union, then we saw the rise of this Islamic terrorism, starting really with Afghanistan. And Gladio B was about taking fascists and actually making it look like they were Islamic terrorists and that they were inspired by Islamic countries and by Islamic leaders.
Well, Sybil Edmonds is originally of Turkish origin, and she was a translator from Turkish for the FBI, and that's how she got access to lots of inside information. And of course, in Turkey itself, Gladio was called Ergonikon, and it was related to, and it was, again, it was a similar setup. But of course, within Turkey, the far right are Islamists. Yeah, so there's not really much of a distinction to be made. You've got secular far rightists and Islamist far rightists, and the point about all of these Gladio operations is that all terrorism, left and right, is orchestrated by the intelligence services, MIT in the case of Turkey, and therefore you have a so-called left-wing bomb which targets the right wing, and a right-wing bomb that targets the left wing. The Islamists then target and of course behind all of this is basically the intelligence services, who are trying to gain more power for themselves in terms of running the country and so on. So we see this is a classic situation now where the failed Islamist insurgency in Syria, because it looks as if it is going to fail, because the Syrian army and the Russians and their other allies are looking like pretty convincing winners at this stage, they're now going to reorient those people to Europe to create hell and disorder so that they can ask for more powers to do more of the same. Now, at what point do people ask the question, we've been supporting Islamist terrorism against the Russians and others from the 1980s onwards, and then you could argue that this is just blowback, we shouldn't have done that, then these crazy people come and attack us. But in actual fact, I would put it stronger than that. I think virtually all of this terrorism is still being orchestrated from within the Western intelligence services.
Now, we're going to be hearing, I mean, this week, actually, I mean, I was quite surprised to see Europol on Monday be quite so adamant that we were going to be seeing car bombs going across Europe. Some sort of intelligence they've got that ISIS has decided that car bombs are the new thing. Obviously, Al-Qaeda's out of the window. We've got this rebranded thing called ISIS, and that car bombs are going to start exploding here in Britain and in other places right across Europe.
Well, if you are, in fact, orchestrating those car bombings, then it's a pretty easy call to make, isn't it? It's a very sinister thing for them to say. I mean, the local police in south of France raided what they thought was an ISIS cell operating from an address, and it turned out that they were all working for the intelligence services, supposedly, on some training exercise. Now, at what point, and are people in Turkey, whether they're of Kurdish extraction or mainstream Turkish-speaking people, are very well aware that's the sort of thing that intelligence services do. When the bomb attacked the Kurdish peace rally, over a year ago now, and 100 people were killed, people immediately, and ISIS claimed it, the Kurds involved immediately pointed the finger at the regime, because that's the kind of thing they do. And Turkey is part of NATO. Their chaps are all trained at Sandhurst. They work closely with MI6. In Britain, we've got this idea that, but surely we wouldn't do stuff like that. In Turkey, people are much more realistic.
Well, Sybil Edmonds is a whistleblower from the FBI. She's Turkish, she was a translator, but very much an insider working in counter-terrorism in the United States and obviously in Turkey too, did a bit of work in Turkey. And then she decided she'd had enough of it because she'd seen that the FBI was actually being used, as you were saying in the first hour, Martin, to entrap people and also to actually conduct terrorist attacks itself through this Gladio network. And she was on the Global Research News Hour recently and talked about Gladio, what she calls Gladio B, but she also talks about what Gladio A was. So we've got Gladio A, which was in the 1970s mainly, where the finger was being pointed at the, or the blame for terrorist attacks in Europe was being put onto the Soviet Union. And then Gladio B, where again it was in a similar way, but against the Islamist group. So let's hear from Sybil Edmonds now.
Operation Gladio is not some kind of a conspiracy term or something that people come up with saying, I believe there was such an operation. Operation Gladio, people can go and do a Google search and they can find it even from the CIA's own division. FOIA documents that in late 1950s, after World War II, after CIA was established, after NATO was established, NATO together with the CIA, they created this paramilitary units, covert paramilitary units around the world, mainly in Europe, some in the Middle East, to counter the Soviet Union and the spread of communism as an ideology. So the role of this paramilitary unit, funded, directed, managed, armed by the CIA and NATO, was during these years in Europe and elsewhere, were to create terror events, you know, blow up bombs, gun down people, set, let's say, a shopping center on fire, and then blame it on the communist networks. And they did hundreds of such operations. There are several good books from historians who have documented these false flag terror events, terror that were created, implemented, brought about by the CIA, NATO's paramilitary units within Eastern Europe, in Italy. And in Italy, they were very big. But the biggest nation that they had the biggest units, which it had its own also office inside the Pentagon, was in Turkey, and that's where I'm from, the Turkish arm of the Gladio network. So they did all this, and you'd think that once the Soviet Union dissolved in 1990-1991, the operation would have been basically shut down, because this was against communism, so-called. That's the basically the competition between the two superpowers. Not per se the communism as ideology. It was the fight for the dominance, global dominance. But they didn't shut it down. They switched that, and they changed the operation from the original operation to Operation B, Gladio Operation B. This time, starting in 1995, 1996, and these are, again, paramilitary CIA, NATO, joint CIA-NATO units in Central Asia, in Caucasus, in Middle East, and in North Africa, utilizing these paramilitary units under fanatic Islam labels and titles and terror organization names, and have them basically create terror events, again, in that part of the world. For example, they have, and this is Gladio Operation B, they have a Chechen network, Chechens, and they have had these units trained inside Turkey, and this is mid-1990s, and it still continues to date. And they arm them, and they set up operational guidelines with targets to, let's say, blow up a school or a movie theater is somewhere in Russia, whether it's in Moscow or in St. Petersburg or elsewhere, or let's say somewhere in Georgia or in Azerbaijan. Same thing with what you see in other parts of the Middle East. So that Operation Gladio turned into a different operation, the same modus operandi of creating false flag events, synthetically created terror units as Islamic fanatic units that would create these terror events, thus the chaos associated with it, thus the justification for NATO, CIA, U.S. military intervention in the Middle East today, but with the goal of having more of these events taking us further into the previously Russian territories. And if you look at the ultimate nations that we will be seeing more and more, we have been seeing it with Middle East, but we will be seeing more and more, it would be in places such as Georgia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, and basically closing further and further towards Russia, because when they do create these events as consequences, it provides the pretext, the justification to interfere and go inside those nations. For example, Azerbaijan is now becoming a NATO member. We have a large base in Azerbaijan. And anybody who would go and look at the map, you see how close it is, you know, to Russia. Or when you're looking at places like Georgia, for example, and Georgia is another candidate for NATO base for to become a NATO member. So that is pretty much in a nutshell of what Operation Gladio is, mm-hmm. and the fiction deals with that. And when I talked about my work with the FBI with this particular special unit under counterintelligence, then I said the files dated back to 1997, well, these files specifically dealt with Operation Gladio B with both Turkish individuals and networks and organizations as actors, target actors, but also with really brand names, U.S. agencies and U.S. individuals, prominent names within the State Department, U.S. State Department in late 1990s and early 2000s, and the CIA, and also within Pentagon.
Now that's Sybil Edmonds, FBI whistleblower there. But Martin, she's talking about places like Azerbaijan, the Caucasus, these places, I mean, Georgia, for example. We hardly hear anything about these places. And yet, at the same time, we're being told by our mainstream media that, oh, that Russia is a threat. Actually, it looks as if we have been using effectively these stay-behind units in many of these countries around Russia to destabilize them and drive them in towards NATO, effectively.
Yes, and of course the Turkey plays a particularly important role in this, because you've got Turkic-speaking people spread right across the Central Asia and into China in the Xinjiang province. And so, for example, the Thai police believe that the bombing of the Hindu temple that took place in Bangkok some time ago was carried out by terrorists from China of Turkic-speaking origin, manipulated by the Turkish intelligence services, who are an integral part of NATO. So you've got to see this as NATO's standard operating procedure. They've been doing it for years. They set up terrorist organisations which they directly control, like the Grey Wolves in Turkey, who are a sort of right-wing terrorist paramilitary. And they also set up or infiltrate existing Islamist or left-wing groups, and then they use their activities in order to justify further repression by the state, surveillance, military intervention. So Turkey, for example, justified its intervention in Syria recently by saying they were going after ISIS, although Erdogan blurted the truth out the other week, last week, when he said, well, the only reason we went in was to get rid of Assad, although the Russians then phoned him up and he had to backtrack. But we all know that that's how it works. In Turkey, where tens of thousands of people have died in the dirty war in Turkish Kurdistan, people are very, very well aware that the NATO intelligence services are terrorists, and we've got to get that through people's heads. Well, MI6 is not a Boy Scout organisation.
Yes, right. Erdogan has just literally within the last few weeks been much more open about the fact that it looks like Turkish troops want to be in Syria to stay. Quite whether they will be or not is another question. And Syria came up this week, as you may have noticed, with Theresa May giving Boris Johnson a bit of a ticking off for talking about the Saudi Arabians particularly, and also, of course, you mentioned the Iran doing these proxy wars in the Middle East, and you got a real slapping down for it. But actually, this is what we've been saying for years.
Indeed, and in actual fact, it's common knowledge. So in a sense, Johnson was only saying what everybody knows.
Interesting.
But of course, as British Foreign Secretary, he ought to have kept his mouth shut, because we're involved as well.
Well, maybe. Interesting. Yeah, so yeah, it's also interesting to see who slapped him down. One of the main people was Malcolm Rifkind, who was on the news, on the who's obviously, he's one of, well, I say obviously, but he's one of these people that takes money from the arms industry. Former chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, really extremely dodgy character, then also Downing Street itself. But it looks like the Foreign Office and many of Boris Johnson's supporters in the Conservative Party are saying, well, hang on a minute, look, he's just saying what the whole of the rest of the world knows, and apparently that's not allowed. But anyhow, let's have a listen to see exactly what Boris Johnson really did say today. So I've got the whole clip, which is a couple of minutes, and he finishes off talking about the puppets and the proxy wars.
There are politicians who are twisting and abusing religion and different strains of the same religion in order to further their own political objectives. And that's one of the biggest problems in the whole, political problems in the whole region. And the tragedy for me, and that's why you have these proxy wars being fought the whole time in that area, is that there's not strong enough leadership in the countries themselves. There are not enough big characters.
Yes.
There are not enough big characters, big people, men or women, who are willing to reach out beyond their Sunni or Shia or whatever group to the other side and bring people together and to develop a national story again. A national story. That's what's lacking. And that's the tragedy. And I've just come from Cyprus, where I've seen one example of how this can happen. And it's not there yet, and it's still very difficult. But you've got two leaders from the Greek community and the Turkish community who are trying, and they're taking risks. They're taking risks, each is taking risks with his own community to try to bring that island together. And I see that in Cyprus, and I have to tell you, I don't see it anywhere else in the region. And that's why you've got international, you've got the Saudis, the Iran, everybody moving in and puppeteering and playing proxy wars. And it's a tragedy to watch it. We need to have some way of encouraging visionary leadership in that area. People who can tell a story that brings people together from different factions and different religious groups into one nation.
Well, the Saudis puppeteering, Martin. What about the Brits and the Americans?
Well, indeed. And when he was mentioning big characters that can bring together different communities, do you know what's popping into my mind? Bashar al-Assad, who's an Alawite with a largely Sunni army crushing Sunni terrorists backed by MI6. And the CIA and Saudi Arabia.
And of course, he's treading in hot water here because, of course, as we know, the former French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, actually said that 2 years before the Arab Spring, that is actually during the Labour government, the pre-coalition government, that he was approached by British officials in London who asked him to join with them in starting some kind of armed uprising within Syria.
Indeed, I mention it week after week. And I believe we have a clip of it.
We do. And for those of you that speak a bit of French, I mean, you don't need to speak loads of French, like Angleterre is England. 2 years is de. I don't know exactly what it is. But anyway, let's have a listen now. It's only about half a minute. But here he is in French saying, effectively.
This was on French TV.
Yeah. On French television saying, effectively, look, the British said to me, let's go and start an armed uprising in Syria. Roland Dumas, former French foreign minister here.
J'étais il y a 2 ans à peu près, avant que les hostilités commencent en Syrie. Je me trouvais en Angleterre par hasard pour d'autres choses, pas du tout de la Syrie. J'ai rencontré des responsables anglais, et quelques-uns qui sont mes amis, m'ont avoué, en me sollicitant, qu'il se préparait quelque chose en Syrie. C'était en Angleterre et pas en Amérique. L'Angleterre préparait l'invasion des rebelles en Syrie. Et on m'a même demandé à moi, sous le prétexte que j'étais ancien ministre des Affaires étrangères, si je participerais comme ça à cette... J'ai évidemment dit le contraire. J'ai dit, écoutez-moi, je suis français, ça ne m'intéresse pas. Mais c'est pour dire que cette opération vient de très loin. Elle a été préparée, conçue, organisée...
So that's Roland Dumas, French Foreign Minister, speaking in French there, mercifully short, but I mean, it's pretty obvious what he's saying, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was, when was that? It was about 2013, wasn't it? And of course he was talking about before 2011. And he's a conservative French Foreign Minister, he was Sarkozy's Foreign Minister. So we have it from the horse's mouth that the uprising in Syria was planned in advance. And if you look at how quickly it turned from what was supposedly peaceful demonstrations into an armed fight with people armed to the teeth and already carrying out pretty sophisticated operations.
Well, we know also
operations.
That British special forces have been in
indeed,
Syria. We spoke
indeed.
To people at the time, didn't we? You've
so in other words, what may happen now is if the Syrian regime manages to re-establish control over their territory and the full investigation is carried out, and we have to apportion blame for the miserable conditions in the country and the many dead and wounded, that people in Britain will have to go and stand trial at The Hague.
So do you think anyone's told Alex Younger, the new Director General of MI6, that this is what Britain's foreign intelligence services have been doing in Syria?
I'm sure he knows. But don't forget, the trade of spies is deception.
That's true. Anyway, let's have a listen now to what he had to say, his first emergence onto the scene since taking over as the boss of Britain's Foreign Intelligence Services, Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. Let's have a listen now to Alex Younger.
As I speak, the highly organised external attack planning structures within Daesh, even as they face military threat, are plotting ways to project violence against the UK and our allies without ever having to leave Syria. In Aleppo, Russia and the Syria regime seek to make a desert and call it peace. The human tragedy is heartbreaking. We cannot be safe from the threats that emanate from that land unless the civil war is brought to an end.
Yes, brought to an end by the defeat of the MI6-backed terrorists. I was on Russia Today last night talking about what's happened in Aleppo. I was mentioning the White Helmets. The White Helmets were set up by former British Army officer James Le Mesurier. They're funded to the tune of millions of pounds, hundreds of millions of pounds, mainly by Western countries, including Britain. And what they do is they are basically a propaganda arm for Al-Qaeda based in Aleppo. And of course, we're not just running their propaganda, we've also supplied them with anti-tank weaponry and with anti-aircraft weaponry, as we have been doing
but
since the 1980s.
Hang on. He's saying, this is Alex Younger, this new MI6 boss, is saying that Russia and Assad are creating a whole new generation of terrorists who are coming on planes, and jets and on boats coming to Britain.
Well, that is absolutely disingenuous because, of course, the terrorists that have been who have come from all over the world, I mean, there's people from all sorts of countries fighting inside Syria, and they've been infiltrated in via Jordan and Turkey by MI6, CIA, MIT. And, of course, if these people then go back to Britain or Europe and carry out terrorist attacks, the presumption has got to be, to any reasonable person, that this is all being orchestrated. Not only have we tried to overthrow the government of Syria, causing untold misery for the people in that country, but it's quite possible that attacks in Brussels and the 7-7 and so on were carried out by our intelligence services as well. And
okay,
of course,
well,
all this relates
to
9-11.
That's a big accusation.
It's a big accusation, but we make it every week.
Forget 9-11 for a minute. Let's look at the 7-7 attacks, the Brussels attacks, Paris attacks, Nice, for example. Can you just give me some examples why you think that may not have been carried out by Islamists, by people within the Western
intelligence? The point is that an Islamist may be made the patsy and may even actually plant the bomb. But the question is, who's the infrastructure behind that? Now, what we know...
Can I have some solid evidence from this?
Well, just one basic thing. At Nice, the local police had CCTV footage of this guy. He wasn't an Islamist. He was actually a bit of a drunkard and a ne'er-do-well, killing supposedly 80 people with a truck. And then the DGSE suggested that the CCTV footage of that should be wiped so that there'd be no evidence of what actually happened. Why would they want to do something like that?
At Nice, it was also interesting to see that the FBI were over in France for weeks and weeks, really shepherding and following around the guy that carried out the Nice attack.
Indeed.
So their fingerprints were all over it.
Yep. So in other words, and if we go back, you said don't mention 9-11, but the fact is that was one of the biggest attacks ever. And I'm afraid the evidence shows that it was an inside job, as is believed by General Ivashov, who was in command of the Russian armed forces on the day.
For the 7-7 London bombings, that's obviously the biggest attack here in Britain, 50-odd people being killed in that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was quite shocked and surprised at is that you've got Benjamin Netanyahu here at the Israeli embassy announcing an hour and a half before the bomb attacks that they were going to go on to a special lockdown because they'd had a warning. Now, I thought it was a surprise attack, and how come the Israeli embassy were warned of it?
Well, indeed, you may well ask, how come there were Mossad agents filming the first plane hitting the World Trade Center who were then arrested subsequently and said, oh, well, we were just documenting the so-called surprise attack?
You know, to look at someone like Netanyahu, he was himself part of the Israeli special forces, wasn't he? He was what you might call a terrorist himself.
Well, indeed, and don't forget that the State of Israel was set up through carrying out terrorist attacks like the attack on the King David Hotel, which killed mostly civilian workers who were working for the British, Arab civilian workers. Terrorism is part of the DNA of the Israeli state and of the British state. and of the US state.
I mean, from a journalistic point of view, what absolutely disgusts me is the way that many of these bomb attacks around the world, terrorist attacks of one sort or another, are simply reported through, you'll get maybe Associated Press, Reuters or whatever, wire copy, which is given to them by the authorities. And that just circulates around the world as truth without any real possibility of questioning by journalists.
Well, what we've got to do is have an understanding of history. The head of the Italian Supreme Court, Imposimato, wrote a book that came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, which he pointed the finger, after decades of investigation by independent police officers in Italy, the finger pointed firmly at NATO, and that includes MI6, for all of those people killed.
So do you think Alex Younger, Europol and the EU, who are talking to all our interior ministers today, are announcing that this may be some kind of quietly announcing this is some sort of Gladio C campaign, taking Gladio on from the Eastern European countries, Azerbaijan, countries to the east of Russia as well, and bringing it right here to home in Europe?
Indeed, and I think we can expect such attacks to take place, but when they do take place, we're going to be asking questions. And the obvious question we're going to ask is, these Islamists that have supposedly come from Syria, maybe they originated in Chechnya, maybe they originated in Turkey, but were they originally recruited by your intelligence services to fight Assad? And were they still working for your intelligence services when these attacks were carried out? Some of them are just patsies, they don't realise they're being manipulated, and they're the ones who end up dead. Some of them are deeply implicated. That's why you need independent police
investigation. Well, one of the things that Sybil Edmonds says is that we're almost trapped into this ISIS story now, and it's a simple story, and it's repeated again and again and again, a bit like Hitler's big lie. So let's have a listen to her finally, a note of sanity to the proceedings on ISIS.
I can speak for the people here in the United States. First of all, for them it's easy to digest, and most people here have been systematically stripped off of their critical thinking ability. They just want some sound bites from the mainstream media. They want sound bites from their TV news. I mean, it's really blurry, the difference between fiction-based sitcoms and what you watch on these types of news with, let's say, CBS or NBC. Mm-hmm. It's very, very blurry, and they work hand in hand, and they accept it. And then we have to admit, they have created, especially since 9/11, an entire industry, you know, from intelligence complex to military industrial complex. As I said, contractors, subcontractors, you are looking at domestically, at least here in the United States, in trillions of dollars. And then if you start going outward and internationally in terms of gaining dominance in the region, and whether it's with Iraq and Syria and the Middle East, or what's going to come, and it has been at work in Central Asia. Ukraine kind of quieted down, but we actually got what we wanted to get out of that. Next, we are going to see, and that's my prediction, we are going to see some unrest in Georgia, because there are going to be these so-called terror events that are going to be blamed on some ferocious Chechen faction that may be collaborating with ISIS faction, and that's going to lead to Georgia's becoming formally, officially accepted into NATO as a member. We already have troops in Georgia. It's already on its way.
Sybil Edmonds there, former FBI translator, now turned whistleblower. But Martin, with the concentration of the media and mainstream media into fewer and fewer hands, actually mind-bending becomes easier and easier.
It does, and that's where your fake news comes from, including fake news about fake news. But the internet still exists, and radio shows like this do exist. And increasingly, by looking at the history, and it is historical fact, by looking at historical facts, we can get people to understand the basic structure of what goes on. There is no doubt in the minds of objective historians that NATO is involved in terrorism in Gladio A and Gladio B. So if there's a Gladio C, we pretty much know where to look to put the blame.
Okay, also, you know, this is kind of mind-bending. It's well worth, I think, looking back at people like Aldous Huxley. He was predicting this kind of thing, the way that society could so easily be manipulated.
Indeed, and I suspect you have a clip which is going to
I certainly do. He called it a kind of technocracy, a kind of scientific dictatorship, far less in your face than George Orwell's 1984.
I would like briefly to compare the parable of Brave New World with another parable which was put forth more recently in George Orwell's book 1984. Orwell wrote his book between 45 and 48, at the time when the Stalinist terror regime was still in full swing, and just after the collapse of the Hitlerian terror regime. And his book, which I admire greatly, it's a book of very great talent and extraordinary ingenuity, is, so to say, a projection into the future of the immediate past, of what for him was the immediate past, and the immediate present. It was a projection into the future of a society where control was exercised wholly by terrorism and the violent attacks upon the mind body of individuals. Whereas my own book, which was written in 1932, when there was only a mild dictatorship in the form of Mussolini in existence, was not overshadowed by the idea of terrorism. I was therefore free, in a way which Orwell was not free, to think about these other methods of control, these non-violent methods. And I'm inclined to think that the scientific dictatorships of the future, and I think there are going to be scientific dictatorships in many parts of the world, will be probably a good deal nearer to the Brave New World pattern than to the 1984 pattern. They will be a good deal nearer, not because of any humanitarian qualms in the scientific dictators, but simply because the Brave New World pattern is probably a good deal more efficient than the other. That if you can get people to consent to the state of affairs in which they are living, the state of servitude, the state of being, having their differences ironed out and being made amenable to mass production methods on the social level, if you can do this, then you are likely to have a much more stable and much more lasting society, a much more easily controllable society than you would if you were relying wholly on clubs and firing squads and concentration camps.
Interesting. Maybe, Martin, what's happening is it's going from a Brave New World style thing here in Britain and in Europe. Obviously, this has been happening in other parts of the world long before this, over to a more 1984, more overt kind of thing.
Don't forget that both books are books of fiction, and reality is stranger than either of them. We've now got a terror state, we've already got a terror state, which uses mind manipulation methods of a Brave New World kind to control the fallout from its own terrorism.
Okay, that's it. That's all for this week, folks. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That's Gary Hopkins from the Lib Dems. Also to Old Lab Oxford economist Martin Summers. Show page for your comments is thisweek.org.uk. Dialects on Tuesday at noon. And you can get the podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Please join us on the Politics Show at the same time next week. God bless, folks. Don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, an independent report says over 1,000 Russian athletes benefited from a state-sponsored doping cover-up at the Olympic and Paralympic Games. It includes London 2012 medalists. Callum Leslie reports.
The message was pretty clear.
The Russian Olympic team corrupted the London Games on an unprecedented scale.
Professor Richard McLaren's report found the country's secret police using salt and coffee to tamper with doping samples. Sochi 2014 and the 2013 World Athletics Championships are also affected. World Anti-